It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. While our physical schools are closed, school is in session on Talk of Iowa. On Tuesdays, we learn about wildlife and nature, and on Thursdays, we dig into Iowa history. This year, our nation is celebrating the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, the amendment that gave women the right to vote. That was the culmination of a long battle for women's suffrage, but it wasn't the end of the fight for equal rights for women. Later this hour, we'll learn about the Equal Rights Amendment. It passed both houses of Congress and was ratified in Iowa in 1972, but it is still not part of the U.S. Constitution. We are going to start off this hour, though, with the women's suffrage movement, a movement in Iowa that was strong. Iowa and Iowans played an important role in the nationwide movement. We'll also, in a few minutes, learn about the often overlooked role that African-American women played in this battle. And joining me right now is Karen Kodrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. Karen, welcome back to the show.
Welcome. Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
Now, there's so much that we can talk about this hour, but we're going to do kind of an abbreviated history of the women's suffrage movement. It was a long, long battle. Let's go back to where it began in the 1840s.
Right. So the seed was planted in 1840 when Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, both of upstate New York, had attended an international suffrage convention in London. And Stanton accompanied her husband, who was a delegate, and Mott and her husband were both delegates to this convention. And this sent the whole convention into a tizzy that these cheeky Americans had actually sent women to this as, you know, voting delegates. So for the entire first day, the abolition convention debated what to do about these women and decided that delegates or no, they had to sit in the back behind a screen and they were not allowed to participate in the debate at the time, even though they were elected delegates. And this so infuriated Mott and Stanton that they decided at that time that they would call a women's rights convention in upstate New York and start to draw some attention to the discrimination against women, which they did in 1848.
So this movement
in Seneca Falls, New York.
Right. This movement really grew out of the abolitionist movement. And just briefly, for people who may not know about the abolitionist movement, of course, that was a movement to try to end the practice of slavery in the United States.
Yes. Yes, so, exactly.
And so this is a spin-off.
And it also kind of stimulated and led to conversations about a number of social reforms. So the abolition movement gave birth to the suffrage movement. It gave birth to temperance. You know, any number of social reforms can actually date back to that effort to end slavery in the United States.
All right. So in 1848 in Seneca Falls, tell me what happened.
Okay. So about 300 people, men and women, mostly women, gathered. And they spent 2 days discussing and debating what should be included in their statement, which was a list of issues that they wanted to put on the public agenda about women. And they called this document the Declaration of Sentiments. It was drafted by Elizabeth Cady Stanton in advance of the convention, and it was patterned after the Declaration of Independence, with some key changes. Like it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men and women are created equal. And then in the part of the Declaration where it goes on to talk about the grievances against King George III, the Declaration of Sentiments then talks about the grievances that they see as abject discrimination against women. And this is true of women of all colors, of course, but they were not allowed to speak in public. They were prohibited from entering most professions. They had few educational opportunities. They could not retain control of any property or wages once they became married. If there was a divorce, they lost custody of their children. So there were a whole list of reforms that they wanted to have put in place. And the single most contentious one was a call for women to have the right to vote.
As women worked through this movement to try to gain support, I think it's important to understand that the people that they needed support from most were men, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we find that, again, the earliest male leaders of the suffrage movement were also abolitionists. So among them were, you know, Stanton and Mott's husbands, but also very notably, and one who attended the Seneca Falls Convention was Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass considered himself a suffrage advocate for his entire life, even though notably he argued against including women in the 15th Amendment, which enfranchised African Americans after the Civil War.
And Frederick Douglass, of course, was a free black man in the United States.
Yes.
and an incredible
right.
thinker and leader. People still study many of the things that he wrote about. He was far before his time. Now,
yeah.
let's talk a little bit about Iowa. Of course, back in 1848, Iowa was the frontier.
And it was a baby state, right? So Iowa had statehood in 1846. But one of the things that I think is really notable about the Iowa suffrage story is that it so closely mirrors what was going on nationally. So to jump back to Seneca Falls, New York, the two most famous women suffragists that came out of Seneca Falls, New York, were Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. And they had a 50-year friendship and partnership where they, really were the face and the voice of the suffrage movement in the United States. But Susan B. Anthony did not attend the women's suffrage or the 1848 convention. She did not meet Susan B. Anthony until 2 years later. And who introduced her? Amelia Bloomer. When Amelia Bloomer was living in Seneca Falls, New York, and before she and her husband, Dexter, moved to Council Bluffs, Iowa. So one of the, I think, really interesting and wonderful and remarkable things about the Iowa women's suffrage story is that Iowa boasts two extraordinarily prominent women's social reformers and suffragists, not just Carrie Chapman Catt, but also Amelia Bloomer.
And Amelia Bloomer. Ladies, if you're wearing pants right now, you probably have Amelia Bloomer to thank.
You can thank Amelia Bloomer. So there's a fairly famous sculpture in Seneca Falls, New York, at the a bronze sculpture of Amelia Bloomer introducing Elizabeth Cady Stanton to Susan B. Anthony at the street corner where that had occurred in 1850. And both Bloomer and Stanton are wearing Bloomers, and it was part of the dress reform that was, again, one of these social movements that was going on simultaneously with both suffrage and abolition.
Now, I want to do a little bit of math here, because we know that this meeting in Seneca Falls, New York, took place in 1848, and we know that right now we are celebrating the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment. So this fight, this campaign went on for decades. So many of the women who
72 years.
72 years. So many of the women who started this movement never saw it come to fruition.
Well, it was not so many. It was almost none. So, for example, of the 75 or so men and women who signed the Declaration of Sentiments at Seneca Falls, only one of them lived to see suffrage enacted. And she was 18 years old in 1848, and then she was obviously in her 80s in 1920. So it really spanned three generations. And from an Iowa perspective, Amelia Bloomer represents that first generation, and Carrie Chapman Catt represents the second generation. And then I think if you want to add a third generation, we would be looking at Ida B. Wise of Clarinda, Iowa, who was also a temperance as well as a suffrage advocate. And she was the president of the Women's Christian Temperance temperance union in both Iowa and nationally. But then she became a child welfare advocate and was a political appointee in both the Hoover and the Roosevelt administrations. So her advocacy work carried on well into the 1940s.
In Iowa, there were some really significant moments. There was a women's suffrage march that took place in Boone. Tell me a little bit about how women tried to rally support in this state.
Yeah, well, again, it really does echo or reflect what was going on nationally. So I think one of the things to remember is that even though women didn't have the right to vote, they did have other civil liberties, you know, freedom of assembly, freedom, right to petition their elected officials. And one of their frequently used strategies was to host these suffrage parades because it was a way to sort of physically occupy space and to show in raw, undeniable numbers the number of women who wanted the right to vote. One of the key arguments against women's suffrage was women don't really want to vote. It's only a few people who are making noise and want this, but they don't speak for all women. So by having hundreds or thousands of women lining up in a parade, usually dressed in white or in their academic robes or something like this, it was a show of force. And the very first parade that dealt with a suffrage issue was actually in Davenport, Iowa in 1888, and it was an anti-suffrage parade. And it was organized by both women and men. And I think it's important to know that in Iowa, as elsewhere in the United States, there were a lot of women who were opposed to suffrage, who simply thought that politics was the world of men, and that if women became involved in politics, they would be corrupted, and they would undermine their traditional authority in the home and the family. But the first suffrage parade, pro-suffrage parade, that happened in Iowa was also very early. It was in 1908. It was organized by Rowena Stevens, who was a Boone area and Ames area suffragist. And it was done to coincide with the statewide meeting of the Iowa Women's Suffrage Association.
And we're going to have to pick it up there in just a moment, Karen. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back. We're talking about the women's suffrage movement in Iowa and around the nation. With me, Karen Kodrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. School is in session today on Talk of Iowa. We are digging into Iowa history, and we're exploring women's suffrage in Iowa and around the nation. And in a little bit, we're going to change or turn our conversation to the Equal Rights Amendment as well. With me is Karen Kodrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. And before I introduce our next guest, Karen, let me let you finish the story about that remarkable suffrage parade in Boone, Iowa in 1908.
Right. So Rowena Stevens had organized that in conjunction with the Iowa Women's Suffrage Association meeting. You know, some of the most iconic photographs that we have of women's suffrage in Iowa come from that particular gathering. And notably, they invited in the president of the National Women's Suffrage Association, who was president at the time, and that was Anna Howard Shaw, who was both a medical doctor and an ordained Methodist minister, and she made her living as a lecturer. And she was president of NASA in between the two times that Carrie Chapman Catt was president.
Now, I encourage anyone listening who is interested in this part of history to go to Iowa PBS because they've been doing a lot of work about women's suffrage this year. And there are a number of short documentaries about different points in women's suffrage in Iowa, including that parade in 1908, and also a documentary about Carrie Chapman Catt, who really helped shepherd the 19th Amendment through the final ratification process. And Karen, we're going to get to that part of the history in a little while, but I do want to bring Eric Morse into the conversation. He is the founding director of the Central Iowa Community Museum, one of the organizations behind a traveling exhibit called Toward a Universal Suffrage, which documents the contributions of African-American women to the suffrage movement in Iowa. Eric, welcome.
Good morning, Charity, and good morning to you, Karen. Nice to hear your voice again.
Hi, Eric.
And I want to bring up this issue of race. As we talked about earlier, the women's suffrage movement was born out of the abolition movement. So the women who started this movement were looking for equal rights for African Americans, were looking for equal rights for men and women. However, as the movement went on, there were some splinters that were created as people made calculations and thought, oh, I think we can possibly get this passed if we do not include Black women, or as we heard earlier, Frederick Douglass, in looking for the right for African-American men to vote, did not include women in that movement. There were a lot of different calculations that were made. But Eric, you've gone back and you have documented the lives of African-American women in Iowa who were involved in this suffrage movement. Tell me a little bit about what you found.
Yeah, so we created this exhibition in partnership with Karen at the Catt Center, and then also in partnership with the Iowa Department of Human Rights and their Office on the Status of Women. And in fact, the exhibition actually originated with the Department of Human Rights, and they did a lot of research about African-American women suffragists who were living and working in Iowa. And so the purpose of this exhibition is to celebrate their contributions and remember them during this important anniversary.
And why is it so important, do you feel, to make sure that these women's stories are told right now?
Right. I think it's important because when we think about kind of that general women's suffrage story, unfortunately, it's a very white story. But we know that there were many African-American women here in Iowa and throughout the country who were also involved in that story. But it was an experience that was different for them because of their race. So in terms of, you know, really memorializing this centennial, it's important to recognize that and then to lift up the voices and the stories of these African-American women.
Let's learn about just a few of the women that are in a part of your exhibit. You share the biographies of a number of really remarkable women. Maybe you could introduce us to Sue M. Wilson Brown.
Yeah, Sue M. Wilson Brown, she's probably my personal favorite. She was a tremendous and exceptional organizer at the state, local, and even the national levels. And she worked very hard to promote political, economic, and the social status of African Americans as a whole. She established and participated in many clubs that she founded to advocate for change. One of the clubs that she founded was the Des Moines Mary Church Terrell Club. That club we know was a suffrage club because it was named after a nationally known African-American suffrage and civil rights activist, Mary Church Terrell. Sue M. Wilson Brown was also the president of the Iowa Federation of Colored Women's Clubs. That club had a standing suffrage committee. And she also worked with the Polk County Suffrage Association, and she spoke at their meetings. They had parades. She marched in their parades, and she helped them distribute their suffrage literature. She continued to work on voting rights even after she gained the right to vote. And she was the first vice president of the, the National League of Republican Colored Women. And she was also the chair of the Polk County Republican Committee. In the election of 1924, the National League of Republican Colored Women worked hard to support the election of Calvin Coolidge. And one of the interesting things that we know about that election is they reported to the Iowa chapter reported to the national organization that one of the unique things that they did in their get out the vote effort at that time was they used the telephone. So if there's anybody listening out there who's gotten a phone call during an election season, know that this is a practice that goes back here in Iowa almost 100 years.
Wow. Well, and we don't have time to talk about all of the people that you profile in this exhibit in depth. I do hope that once museums open again, that so many people in Iowa will get a chance to experience this exhibit. Why don't you just very briefly tell us also about a remarkable attorney and Okay, before you do that, actually, Karen, you did a beautiful job earlier putting things into perspective for us about the challenges that women faced. But let's talk about Black women in America, because their challenges were so much greater.
Yes, because they faced both racism and sexism, and then a particular kind of discrimination as African-American women. And they tended to just get left out of the conversation. So, you know, early on, the 15th Amendment, Frederick Douglass argued that African-American men needed to be enfranchised before women because of the burden of slavery and the threats to their very lives that they faced, which was all true. But that ignored, of course, the burden of slavery that fell upon African-American women. And then there were a number of suffragists that really supported suffrage for white women only. And this was especially true in the American South, but not exclusively. Notably, when the 19th Amendment was ratified and women were enfranchised in Iowa, that included African-American women. And there were about 5,000 African-American women of voting age that were living in Iowa at the time who gained a right to vote along with their white sisters.
There has been a lot of conversation about race and women's suffrage because of something that Carrie Chapman Catt, it's because of so many things, but also because of something that Carrie Chapman Catt wrote as she was working to get this amendment ratified all around the country. I mean, there were some ugly compromises made as leaders from the North worked in the South.
Right. And the National Association varied in its position on whether or not states should be permitted to disenfranchise African-American women. Eventually, under Catt's leadership in the later years, they moved solidly towards a federal amendment, which they knew would enfranchise African-American women unless and until states moved to disenfranchise them because of their race. And this was a highly contentious issue. Carrie Chapman Catt was in the very difficult position of trying to make sure that she held together a very squeamish and diverse coalition. And she knew that her suffrage advocate sisters in the South faced as a crucial argument against suffrage that it would enfranchise African-American women. So she made a demographic argument that if women's suffrage was put in place, that it would not undermine white supremacy simply because white voters would continue to outnumber African-American voters. She does not ever say that she herself supports, that she supports white supremacy, but that comment has been taken out of context to imply that she did exactly that. But if you read the entire argument, she goes on to say that she believes that such arguments like this and others are ridiculous and that suffrage for one needs to be suffrage for all.
I want to take just a very brief moment, Eric, for you to introduce us to another one of the women, Gertrude Elorza Rush. She was a suffragist and an attorney, which is such a remarkable thing given the time that she lived.
Right, she was. And she's really an Iowan that I think everybody should know about. So she was also involved in a lot of organizations that were dedicated to African-American women's rights. And like Sue M. Wilson Brown, she also spent time serving as the president of the Iowa Federation of Colored Women's Clubs. She was the president of that organization from 1911 to 1915. And that was a very important organization for African-American women in Iowa. I mentioned that they had a standing committee around suffrage, but they also advocated in the areas of health and education and social service. One of the things that they did around education was that club created a dormitory for African-American women at the University of Iowa. Anyway, Gertrude was also involved in the suffrage movement nationally. She was a speaker at the Baptist Women's Convention, and she spoke there on the topic of suffrage. And she believed that if women got the vote, that they would that would lead to better working conditions. She said that they would also experience higher wages and greater opportunities in business, and that it would help end discrimination and lynching, which was a very important thing that African Americans were looking to end, and other legal injustice. She passed the Iowa bar exam in 1918, but she was denied admittance into the American Bar Association. So what she did in response to that discrimination was her and four other African American men founded what is now known as the National Bar Association, and they did that in 1925. The next time anyone is in Des Moines, I would encourage them to go to the intersection of 2nd Avenue and Grand Avenue. There is a sculpture by Kerry James Marshall there. It's called A Monumental Journey. And that sculpture memorializes the creation of the National Bar Association here in Iowa. Gertrude was the first African-American woman to practice law in Iowa. And she was the only one to do so all the way up until the 1950s.
Karen, I want to just underscore the fact that when the 19th Amendment became part of the Constitution, yes, it gave women the right to vote, but that was not the end of really the suppression of women's votes or the suppression of so many votes from people of color in this country. In fact, that is a battle that continues to today. What is the most important thing to understand about that?
Well, I think one of the things to remember is that the 19th Amendment itself did not mention race. So women, there were women who were not enfranchised after the 19th Amendment. Most of them were, of course, women of color, but they were disenfranchised because of their race, not because of their sex. So the 19th Amendment enfranchised women wherever the men of the same race were enfranchised. But of course, you know, it took, you know, another 4 or 5 years before Native Americans who lived on reservations were enfranchised. It took until the 1940s before Asian Americans were enfranchised. And of course, African Americans living in the South were not fully enfranchised until after the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Poll Tax Amendment of 1964. And we do continue to have ongoing conversations about who should have the right to vote, what are the requirements to vote, and how do we make sure that everyone has equal access to the polls.
I want to go to the phones. You can join our conversation 866-780-9100. Jane is on the line in Algona. Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Hi. Briefly, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I just wanted to mention that there are two women who were very important in Algona in the suffrage movement. And one was Lizzie B. Reed, who had moved to Peru, Indiana, and started her own semi-monthly newspaper, The Mayflower, with articles on literature and temperance and women's rights. And then when she moved on to Iowa, that newspaper later became famous as The Lily, published by Susan B. Anthony. And she was the second woman to be elected as the Iowa women's suffrage president. And then Caroline Ingham was also, she came to Iowa. They both had come from New York originally, and they both landed in Algona in 1865 in the town. And Caroline gave a speech at the July 4th party gathering at the fairgrounds in 1869 about women's rights. And while she did that, her husband held her baby, and that became the he became sort of ridiculed nationally in cartoons by about holding a baby while his wife spoke.
Wow. Well, Jane, we're nearly out of time, but thank you so much for sharing those stories. And there are so many great stories in so many of our communities all over the state. And Karen, as people are celebrating this 100th anniversary, how would you suggest that they find out more, maybe about even the people in their own communities who were part of this movement?
Well, first of all, I would recommend that they to find out what celebrations are going on, to go to the Hard Won Not Done website. So it's 19thAmendmentCentennial.org, and on there is a calendar of events that we are doing across Iowa to celebrate the 19th Amendment. And given the pandemic and that so many things are up in the air, we are going to extend our official celebration through 2021.
Excellent.
In addition, Louise Nouns is also a notable Iowa historian, and she has written about the suffrage movement, and that's another good place to start.
All right, we are going to take a short break here. Eric, thank you so much for being here and for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you, Charity.
Eric Morse, founding director of the Central Iowa Community Museum. That's one of the organizations behind a traveling exhibit called Toward a Universal Suffrage, which documents the contributions of African-American women to the suffrage movement in Iowa. Karen Kudrowski is going to stay with us. She is director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. And in a moment, we're going to find out about the battle over the Equal Rights Amendment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're delving into Iowa history, and we've been talking about women's suffrage in Iowa, the fight leading up to the passage of the 19th Amendment. We're celebrating the centennial of that 19th Amendment this year, and as Karen Kudrowski shared a moment ago, we're going to continue celebrating into next year with so many events being canceled due to the worldwide pandemic. Now we're going to turn our attention to the Equal Rights Amendment. Of course, we know that because of the 19th Amendment, women gained the right to vote, but that didn't end the battle for equal rights for men and women. The Equal Rights Amendment passed both houses of Congress. It was also ratified in Iowa and a number of other states in 1972, but it is still not part of the U.S. Constitution. Karen Kudrowski is still with us, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. And Karen, give us a thumbnail sketch of the Equal Rights Amendment and how it was put forward back in the 1970s.
Okay, so before I do that, I do want to mention that if people are interested in seeing the Toward a Universal Suffrage display, that they, or to book it for their local library or museum once everything opens up again, is that they should go to the Central Iowa Community Museum website, and all that information is there. Now, the ERA. So the Equal Rights Amendment was first introduced into Congress actually in 1923. And Alice Paul, who led a competing organization to Carrie Chapman Catt, the National Women's Party, in the 19-teens and 1920s, dedicated the rest of her life to promoting the Equal Rights Amendment. And it was passed in 1972 by rather comfortable margins once it got out of committee, and the accompanying legislation indicated that there would be a 7-year time frame for states to ratify, and that 38 states needed to ratify the ERA. And so the Equal Rights Amendment, a number of states ratified very, very quickly. Like literally Hawaii ratified within minutes of when it was passed out of the Congress. And Iowa was among them, ratified in 1972. And then as the ratification process slowed down, opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment began to solidify. And by the time the implementing legislation timeline had expired in 1979, only 35 states had ratified.
And they needed 38.
And then the Congress extended the ratification timeline another 3 years to 1982. And in that 3-year period, not any additional states ratified. And 5 states actually rescinded their ratifications, which was questionable. It is an unsettled question as to whether or not states have the power to rescind a constitutional amendment that they've already ratified. Having said that, so the arguments against the Equal Rights Amendment, which were really contentious at the time to our you know, 2020 ears seem a little absurd. So one of them was a concern that this would lead to women in combat roles and women being drafted. Well, we don't have a draft, number one. But number two, President Obama, by executive order, has already opened up combat roles in the military to women. Secondly, is that it would lead to unisex bathrooms and that sexual predators would then hover in these unisex public bathrooms and attack young women and girls as they went into the bathrooms. Well, of course, if you go to many public places now, you see unisex bathrooms. Sometimes they're just labeled unisex. Sometimes they're called family restrooms and things like that. And this just seems to be an effort of inclusion rather than one where there's any, you know, major security concern. The third one was that it would lead to gay marriage, which, of course, is already law of the land based upon the Obergefell Supreme Court decision. So fast forward to 1992, and the 27th Amendment is added to the United States Constitution. And the 27th Amendment, which deals with congressional pay, has an interesting history insofar as it was first introduced in the 1780s as one of the original Bill of Rights. So here's an ironic a little known fact is that Congress passed 12 amendments to the Constitution as part of the Bill of Rights, and only 10 were ratified by 1791. And the 11th one was ratified 200 years later. So what this told ERA advocates is that there is no timeline for ratifying a constitutional amendment. So advocates began what they called the three-state strategy, which is really more accurately the three-more-state strategy. And they made an effort to get three more states to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. And hopefully that would lead to it being added to the Constitution.
Which
and that has now occurred.
Right. That's where we stand right now. 38 states have ratified. And let's put a pin in that, Karen, and we'll pick up that story in a few moments because, of course, we're always living history as well. So we'll bring it up to the present day. But I want to bring somebody who was a big part of this movement into the conversation. Jean Lloyd-Jones is with us. She was elected to the Iowa General Assembly in 1978, serving four terms in the House, two terms in the Senate. But her work and her political influence goes far beyond the state capitol, and working toward equality for women has been one of the defining principles of her career. She is on the line with us. Hello.
Hello, Charity, and hello, Karen. Nice to see you. Nice to hear you.
Well, it's lovely
to hear your voice.
Lovely to hear your voice. And will you take us back in time a little bit? As I mentioned, you were elected to the Iowa General Assembly in 1978. But before that, you were very involved in working toward the Equal Rights Amendment. Karen gave us a nice summary of some of the controversy surrounding that amendment. But tell us a little bit about your experience in Iowa.
Karen did a wonderful job of summarizing everything that's gone on, and I'm happy to jump in here with my own personal observations. In 1972, when the National Amendment was first voted in, I was president of the Iowa League of Women Voters. And I remember feeling like I was a bridge, trying to be a bridge, between the established League of Women Voters, with its great reputation for study and so forth, and who considered itself the women's movement, trying to bridge their gap between the League and the new people who were working for the Equal Rights Amendment. And it was not easy because, as has already been pointed out, there were lots of women who did not want to give up their privileges. You know, Phyllis Schlafly made this big thing about it's wonderful. I love having my husband go out and do, you know, into the real world and do the work of the public work, while I have the privilege of staying at home and raising my family. I mean, that kind of argument was very, very deep-seated.
And, so we're getting to see a little bit of a window into that with the new Netflix series, Mrs. America, which is all about Phyllis Schlafly. But can you tell me how you felt as a woman working so hard for the Equal Rights Amendment to hear those arguments and to have other women pushing back against you?
Well, it was very disappointing to me. And part of what I felt was that the women who were arguing for the ERA tended to characterize all men as the enemy. And we know that that is not the case. Women would not have ever gotten the right to vote without men. They were the ones who had to vote and had to pass the amendment. There are many men who have supported women in their struggle for equality. So that was disappointing to me. And I think that we understood that behind those arguments that Karen mentioned about using same-sex bathrooms and so forth, there was a deeper fear, and that fear has to do with the power, giving up the power, which white men have always held in this country and in several other countries. And so pitting men against women as enemies, I think, has always been the struggle for me. I mean, I have always wanted it to be about partnership and mutual respect and understanding of what the gifts are that the other genders bring, so that we can work together as a team and not as competitors. That is a far cry from where this country is today.
And this, looking back over this journey, you bring an interesting perspective, because you also worked very hard in Iowa to create the gender balance bill and to try to make sure that equal rights for men and women are part of Iowa law. At some point, did you think I can't focus my energy on the Equal Rights Amendment? We need to take another path toward this journey.
I personally did not focus my attention on the ERA. I always supported it, but I do believe that there are other pathways to help women. I still believe in it, because I think we need that constitutional guarantee of equality, because the only right that women have in our Constitution is the right to vote. All the rest are, you know, other laws, but they're not in our Constitution. So when I was in the House, the Iowa House of Representatives, I chaired the State Government Committee. And when Governor Branstad decided to do a major overhaul and reorganize the state administration, our committee, which consisted of 9 women and 7 men, I think, introduced the amendment of gender balancing and said that all state boards and commissions that were appointed, not the elected ones, you can't do that, but the appointed boards and commissions must be gender balanced. And we're the only state in the nation that has that requirement.
And that was in 1987, but that rule, that law was extended not very long ago, right?
That's correct. A future legislature has extended that to all local boards and commissions, which I think is a great step, you know, to take, because we want women to advance and to be promoted and so forth, but unless they have experience at some level of government, they're probably not going to get to the top tier.
Jean Lloyd-Jones, thank you so much for sharing your personal experience with us again. Jean Lloyd-Jones was elected to the Iowa General Assembly in 1978, served 4 terms in the House, 2 terms in the Senate. Please take care and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Karen, we have just 2 minutes left here. We put a pin in this moment in time right now. So now 38 states have ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. As you mentioned earlier, some states had rescinded their ratification, so that raises a lot of questions. And we're well over the time limit that was originally allowed for ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. Where does this stand right now?
Well, there are 3 potential paths to see the Equal Rights Amendment ratified. All of which are being worked on to some degree or another. Number one is that Congress could pass legislation that rescinds the time limit. And that is actually active legislation that's been introduced into the House of Representatives, and there's an effort to start lobbying members of the House to pass it. The second one would be to use the courts and to have the courts declare that the time limit is unconstitutional. And the third one, but both of those leave unresolved the issue of whether or not states can rescind. There have been a number of constitutional amendments that states have rescinded their ratifications of, but only after the amendments have been added to the Constitution. So, but to do it before the amendment is fully ratified is an open question. And then the third one would be to simply reintroduce the amendment into the House and the Senate again and to start the process over with presumably 38 states supporting it.
So this history is not yet written. From your knowledge of history and politics, where do you think it'll go?
I think the clearest path forward is actually the hardest one, which is the notion of reintroducing the amendment. Because then there would be no question about the legitimacy of the amendment if it was sort of had a clean ratification record without any rescissions. But of course, I do expect that there would be opposition that organizes against it. It would just need to have different kinds of arguments.
All right. Well, the story continues. Karen Kodrowski, thank you so much for being on the program today.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Karen Kodrowski is director of the Carey Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. We've been talking about the fight for equal rights for women in a couple of different ways this hour. We've talked about the women's suffrage movement in Iowa history and also the Equal Rights Amendment in Iowa history, an amendment that was ratified by Iowa in 1972, but still is not part of the U.S. Constitution. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.